With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for tuning in this morning to the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, additional funding to support a citrus breeding program. We'll have details on that. But our top story today. The Senate Ag Appropriations Committee held a hearing Tuesday to examine the President's fiscal year 2025 budget request for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack detailed several priorities for agriculture in the President's budget request.
Clearly, we need to continue to look at ways in which we can focus on things like PFAS, HPAI, and some of the other challenges that are faced out in the countryside. I appreciate the opportunity to acquaint the committee with the challenges of our ARS facilities, particularly in Beltsville, the need for significant investment there and improved, and the importance of containing and retaining the flexibility within the CCC in order to allow us to respond to situations that crop up from time to time. Most recent example, fertilizer. We're now in the process of funding at least 42 projects that are helping to tamp down the costs and increase in fertilizer.
Vilsack made a commitment to lawmakers regarding the CCC, or Commodity Credit Corporation, which is a government-owned and operated entity that was created to stabilize, support, and protect farm income and prices.
Is that we will never, ever, ever drain the account. We'll never just, for one thing, as has happened in the past, drain the account and force you to replenish it. We are very sensitive to the importance of maintaining some set of fiscal responsibility in the utilization of those tools.
What are some findings in USDA's latest Census of Agriculture when it comes to the breakdown of farm operations by gender? Rod Bain looks into it.
The latest edition of the Census of Agriculture, covering the year 2022, provided the Agriculture Department and census users and stakeholders opportunity to learn more about the people within the ag sector. Some of the demographic data points, according to National Agricultural Statistics Service statistician Virginia Harris, include structure of the farm operation by gender. For instance,
farms with at least one female producer are much less likely to be operated by a single person. Most women are involved in farms with other people. Just 11% of farms with a female producer have just one person involved, while men are much more likely to be operating farms as sole operators of that farming operation.
A further breakdown of data on women in farms reveals
female producers account for 36% of all producers, while almost 60%, 58% to be exact, of farms have at least one female producer on the operation. On average, farms with female producers are smaller, both in acreage and in sales.
There are also notable demographics regarding female farm operators by region.
Farms in the western part of the country are much more likely to have a female producer than those farms in the Midwest.
The census from cycle to cycle introduces new questions to further expand understanding of what certain data objectives mean. One example, in the 2022 census, a new question on the survey form asked about marketing decisions on the farm by gender. 61% of male producers make farm marketing decisions, while 50% of women make marketing decisions associated with the farm. Regarding other operation decision aspects,
female producers, their highest participation in decision making were in the categories of day-to-day decisions, record keeping, and financial management aspects of the farm. Male producers were much more involved than female producers in making decisions about land use and crops.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The latest Consumer Price Index report covering March shows food price inflation at the grocery store came to a halt. Gary Crawford has more.
The government's Consumer Price Index for March has been getting a lot of serious attention, serious press, because it showed an unexpectedly high rate of annual inflation, 3.5% in the general economy, and it recorded a fairly high one-month increase of 0.6%. However, experts say, unlike during the COVID pandemic when food prices were soaring, you cannot blame this new run of inflation on food. In fact,
food at home or grocery prices were actually flat in March.
No increase at all. This from Agriculture Department economist Megan Schweitzer, who told us,
Overall, we continue to see inflation slow or stabilize across both of the major categories of food for groceries and restaurant products. And so while food prices are still increasing, particularly on the restaurant side, food is not one of the major contributors to inflation on an economy-wide scale in March.
Not at all.
Overall, what was really driving price increases across the economy in March this year were the categories of shelter and of energy, particularly gasoline.
Yes, gas prices rose by almost 6.5% last month. Now, you would think higher gas prices means higher transportation costs, and that would push up the cost of food. And Megan Schweitzer says yes.
Energy prices are an input into the food production process, but it's one of many components that feeds into food prices. Food processing and packaging and wholesaling and retailing. And so you have all of these factors feeding into food prices.
But they didn't feed in enough to raise retail prices during March. In fact, she says that last month, of the 15 major food categories that she tracks, prices went up for 9 of them, down for 6.
For the most part, we saw prices increase for categories across the meats, poultry, and fish categories. Prices declined for dairy products, for fats and oils, sugar and sweets, cereals and bakery products, and for fresh fruits and fresh vegetables.
Leaving overall grocery store food prices up from this time a year ago by only 1.2%. Oh, and Schweitzer says some foods are selling for less than a year ago, namely eggs, dairy products, and fish and seafood. On the other side of the scale, beef prices are rising rapidly. Last month, prices averaged about 7.5% higher than March of 1 year ago. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
You're listening to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. In today's National Spotlight, don't forget your training before using any existing stocks of dicamba products. Michael Clements has more.
Farmers need to remember that training is mandatory for everyone planning to use existing stocks of low volatility dicamba products like Bayer's Xtendimax herbicide with vapor grip technology, which has been classified as a restricted use pesticide. Training helps farmers to achieve safe applications of these products and is essential to product stewardship that helps farmers maintain these useful tools. Jennifer Stutz, North American Weed Management and Chemistry Stewardship Manager for Bayer, talks about Bayer's efforts to get everyone trained for the season.
We launched a flexible, easy-to-use online dicamba training platform on RoundupReadyExtend.com/training. It offers a simple and efficient way for farmers to meet the EPA training requirement, no matter how many states they farm in.
The training covers everything a farmer needs to know about dicamba applications.
While Bayer experts present the training, it covers everything applicators and farmers need to know to apply existing stocks of low-volatility dicamba products by using Roundup Ready Extend technology, including the following products: Bayer's Xtendimax herbicide with vapor grip technology, BASF's Ingenia herbicide, and Syngenta's Tavium plus vapor grip technology. Topics covered in the course include application timing, record keeping, sprayer cleanout, using volatility reducing adjuvants, determining buffer distances, application conditions specific to certain states, and dicamba restrictions. It also covers how to check for pesticide use limitation areas on the EPA Bulletin's Live 2 websites, how to help reduce the potential for drift, and best management practices for dicamba application.
Farmers can access the training online.
So the self-guided course typically takes less than an hour. Farmers and applicators need a strong internet connection and an updated web browser. We recommend Chrome, Firefox, or Safari. The computer-based training is convenient, and it's available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Once you click to begin the course, you've got 24 hours to complete it, and you don't have to complete it all at once. Register for the course and get started right away.
Bayer has also simplified the training for farmers who farm in multiple states.
The training program is designed so that farmers and applicators can complete the required training for more than one state at a time. Farmers just need to select the states for where they're going to apply, and the program will adjust to include requirements specific to those states. Once they've completed the program, they'll receive a printable certificate for proof of training, including each state for which they've selected.
Stutz says Bayer is committed to helping farmers be successful.
At Bayer, we're committed to positioning farmers and applicators for success in 2024 and beyond. And we know making it as easy as possible for them to educate themselves and meet the requirements for certification is a critical first step. Access Bayer's dicamba training by visiting roundupreadyextend.com and clicking on training and stewardship to register.
That's Jennifer Stutz, Bayer North American Weed Management and Chemistry Stewardship Manager. Michael Clements reporting.
That's today's National Spotlight. In today's Livestock Report, every month, Dr. Glenn Tonser, a livestock market economist with Kansas State University, releases a meat demand monitor. Tonser says the latest data from March shows some good news.
The good news for the industry would be is retail demand, so think go to the grocery store for consumption at home, was up on 5 of the 8 products we examined in March compared to February, and actually several cases were up compared to March of 2023, which is good. Specifically, ground beef was up, pork chops down slightly, bacon a little bit off, chicken breast up. They're not major changes, but retail demand appears to be holding up pretty well is what I would highlight there.
He also looks at food service demand.
Food service demand, however, was actually up on all examined, maybe reversing a pattern. And please note, I emphasize maybe because there's a tone in my voice here, is there's other evidence that food service demand is still soft. I hope the March MDM is the right one and not kind of the outlier that was wrong for a month. As we've started here 2024, retail demand has been okay. Food service been a little softer. Cost of a meal have reflected elevated labor costs and other things. And more households concerned about their budget have just consumed more at home and demand's been higher for at home.
Tonser also quizzes consumers about what matters to them when making purchasing decisions.
So the way we measure that in the MDM is called protein values. We give them a list of 12 things like taste, safety, price, all the way to like environmental impact, and ask what are the 4 of these 12 that are most important when you're making a protein purchasing decision, and what are the 4 that are least important, the 4 you don't pick are intermediate. So I have this forced rank exercise, and we do that so that you can't tell me all 12 are the most important thing in your life, because that's forced trade-offs tell us more. We continue to see that for the average person in March, taste, freshness, safety, and price remain the 4 most important. More directly, they are the ones most often in the top 4 bucket. Conversely, things like environmental impact, origin traceability, animal welfare, use of hormones and antibiotics rank quite lower.
In other news, month-over-month adjustments in USDA turkey production and price forecasts reflect both trending lower. Rod Bain has more.
Month-over-month increases in both production and price of meats per USDA's April forecast, with one exception.
Virtually unchanged forecast for turkey production this month, and with turkey seeing a persistent poor demand outlook for turkey, unfortunately, and those prices have been under pressure as a result. Year-over-year, turkey prices were looking at 2024 compared to 2023, down by about 35.8 cents per pound.
World Agricultural Outlook Board Chair Mark Jankowski says both steer and hog prices rose well over $2 per pound this month, both based on strong demand. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
We'll be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's AgNet West headlines, here's AgNet West Farm News Director, Brian German.
Engagement with the farming community is critical before legislating on its behalf. Director of Education and Communications with the Stanislaus County Farm Bureau, Anna Genasi, said they're always ready and willing to talk with people about how proposed laws could impact agriculture.
Before, you know, rules and regulations are passed that impact farm workers, folks need to ask farm workers what they actually want. I think there's this gap in communication between what people think is good for our farming community and what really is good for our farming community. And the most notable issue right now is the change to the ag workday. And as a result, now farm workers are actually taking home less money. And so that's always my plea from a Farm Bureau perspective. Like, if you see something on the ballot that impacts agriculture, give Farm Bureau a call and get our perspective on it.
The Certified Biostimulant Program from the Fertilizer Institute has announced the first certification for a biostimulant product under the recently launched program. TFI President Corey Rosenbusch highlighted the vigorous review process, ensuring adherence to industry standards in efficacy testing and methodology. AgroLiquid's C-Tech biostimulant product is the first to receive the certification from TFI. Certified products receive a distinctive label assuring agricultural retailers and consumers of meeting established standards. The initiative aligns with U.S. biostimulant industry guidelines, emphasizing comprehensive documentation and safety measures. Rosenbusch emphasized the program's significance in providing a standard for evaluating and recommending biostimulant products, enhancing environmental stewardship, and supporting crop yields. Updates to the WIC program are receiving mixed responses. The International Fresh Produce Association has applauded the updates from USDA, emphasizing the positive impact on nutrition security for vulnerable populations. The association highlights the flexibility in food packages and the alignment with dietary guidelines, particularly in promoting fruit and vegetable access. At the same time, the National Milk Producers Federation and the International Dairy Foods Association have expressed disappointment and concern over the finalized rule. They argued that the decision reduces dairy access and contradicts established nutrition science and the dietary guidelines for Americans. USDA reports that the updates will provide participants with a wider variety of foods to support healthy dietary patterns and allow WIC state agencies more flexibility in administering the program to accommodate personal and cultural food preferences. Congress has allocated an additional $500,000 to help support a new citrus breeding program in Parlier. Both the Citrus Research Board and California Citrus Mutual have praised congressional leaders for approving the extra funding. Yearly federal support for the program is now set to reach $1.5 million, with an additional $500,000 provided by CRB annually. The breeding program aims to develop high-quality citrus selections suitable for California's growing conditions, consumer preferences, and disease resistance. The expansion complements the existing USDA Agricultural Research Service program in Florida. Collaboration between the two states and the University of California's citrus breeding program will help deliver results for California-based growers. The program's location in Parlier has received initial funds for staffing, construction planning, and site expansion. The annual Western Food Safety Conference is coming up next month in Salinas. The conference is an annual two-day event designed especially for food safety industry leaders. The event will be held at Sherwood Hall in Salinas on May 1st and 2nd and will focus on creating a safe and transparent food supply chain. The conference will provide participants with current produce safety information, research, and regulatory developments in the fresh produce industry. Speakers and panelists include experts in water quality, data science, sustainable agriculture, and state and federal regulation. Topics of discussion will include the future of AI in advancing food safety and quality management, FSMA traceability rule 204 compliance, reducing heavy metals in produce, and assessing the health of wells and water systems. More information about the conference is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
The Ag Department is bringing more healthy foods to more people. Gary Crawford has the story in today's This Land of Ours report.
In this country today, there are still places where people don't have easy access to fresh, healthy foods, such as fruits and vegetables, but there's a lot of work going on to change that. The latest development coming this week from Deputy Agriculture Secretary Xochitl Torres-Small, who told reporters,
USDA Rural Development and the Reinvestment Fund are announcing the selection of 16 partnerships that will receive more than $40 million in grants under the Healthy Food Financing Initiative Partnerships Program to expand access to nutritious and affordable foods in 20 states and in Washington, D.C.
Grants will be used by local organizations to do things like establishing new local markets and supply chains and helping local food retailers to offer more fresh produce for their customers.
So people who live in some of the most remote parts of the country don't have to travel so far from home to find fresh, healthy food.
And farmers don't have to ship their products hundreds of miles just to find buyers for them. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. Here's Chuck Zimmerman.
I'm visiting with Han Chen with ZCAL, and I'd like, first of all, Han, tell us a little bit about yourself and the company.
Well, Chuck, it's great to be back on. Thank you again for having us. For those of your listeners that may not remember us, ZCAL is a plant traits company. We've developed a technology called PhotoSeed, which enhances photosynthesis in crops. We've been working primarily in soybeans over the past few years and bringing that to market. But today, we're happy to announce that we have gotten PhotoSeed working in the other largest crop here in the U.S., which is corn.
So for people that don't really understand the kind of work that you do, tell us a little bit about this PhotoSeed trait technology in particular. How does it work?
Yeah, so growers are obviously very experienced with traits, which is genetics that confer new properties to crops, give them better functionality, better performance. In the case of PhotoSeed, what we're really doing is changing the way that plants capture sunlight and capture carbon dioxide. So we're taking the biggest existential challenge to humanity, which is rising CO2 levels, and we're creating better carbon sinks in the plants so that they're taking up more CO2. But what's more important about the CO2 once it's fixed inside the plant is, what is the plant doing with it? Well, our genetics are also transferring the CO2 into more valuable products, typically in the form of higher oil and higher protein. And in the case of corn today, what we're able to develop is a photosynthetically enhanced corn that's sucking up more carbon dioxide and making higher oil content.
Today we're talking about PhotoSeed corn just being announced. What is this going to mean to growers?
Well, PhotoSeed corn, just like all of our other programs, means creating new value for growers on a per acre basis. So right now, growers are really being paid on one metric, which is yield. But when that crop goes into the supply chain, yield kind of becomes secondary to what does that crop represent. And the reason why we grow these crops is for their oils, proteins, and sugars, oils and protein being the most valuable. In the case of corn, and specifically high oil corn, what we've been seeing in recent years is just a tremendous demand surge for plant-based oil feedstocks that's going into renewable energy. This is sustainable aviation fuel. This is renewable diesel. And we just don't have any more acreages to plant more crops. So we have to really focus on the productivity that we have today, but changing that mix so that the plants are creating components or metabolites that are actually more valuable for industry. So in our results, we're getting 20% more oil in the plant. That's 20% more oil per acre that we don't have to put any more inputs into. We don't need any more land to produce it. And that's going to really solve the feedstock demand for a lot of our industrial partners that are looking for that feedstock security.
I think you touched on this, but why is higher oil content so important to the marketplace today?
If you go to the biology, oil is the hardest thing to create. It requires 2.25 times the energy to create sugars. So immediately, if you think about oil just from a productivity and energy intensity standpoint, it is the most difficult thing to get. In corn, corn is already one of the most productive crops in the world. That comes from decades of breeding, hybridization, you know, trait technologies and all that. But corn right now is primarily used for ethanol and animal feed. By adding this oil component or enhancing this oil component, we're essentially creating a new product stream that's more valuable than any of the other components. So right now, a lot of ethanol players, you know, they're addressing the fuels market with the ethanol play on the sugar side, but the oil represents a very small part of that product stream, despite being the most valuable. Any ethanol player would tell you, if I could get more oil per acre, that's going to change the productivity of my business. So beyond offering that feedstock security, the other key part of this is we're going to be driving down the carbon intensity score of crops like corn and soybeans with this technology. There's a big conversation right now about food versus fuels, and a lot of that is negatively impacting the so-called carbon intensity scores of our major crops. But when you have so-called found oil, meaning that you're producing more oil per acre without additional inputs, without taking away land that could otherwise be used for food purposes, all of that's going to improve the sustainability profile, the carbon intensity score, and that's a new monetary opportunity, not only for our industrial partners, supply chain partners, but ultimately a new revenue stream for growers as well.
Yeah, the food versus fuel debate has been going on for quite a while. But when it comes to PhotoSeed corn, how are you going to help produce food, feed, and fuel? And maybe that kind of negates that concern.
There's no silver bullet to any of this, Chuck, as you know. The demand for fossil fuels is tremendous. And corn and soybeans, you know, despite being food crops, is also our best way to meet it because of the supply chain that's already being set up and also the productivity of these crops, as I mentioned, from just generations of research. The way that we're going to try to address this is really through carbon capture. So carbon is, you know, a negative impact in our environment. We are going to be taking that carbon out of the air, and we're going to be elevating it into the highest value product, which is the oil. So going back to my concept of found oil, this is really changing the mix. This is almost like changing mass balance analysis or creating something out of nothing, because we're basically monetizing a free and even a cost to society, which is CO2, and making sure that we're improving the amount of oil that we're producing on a per acre basis. So again, a grower gets to grow this in exactly the same way without having to increase his input costs. Our refining and fermentation partners on the ethanol side get to use the same volume of feedstock, but also create more valuable, abundant products.
Well, before we close, is there anything else you want growers or others to know that we didn't touch on?
Well, we always want to connect with the industry. And so the easiest way is to visit our grower resource page and the ZCAL website at www.zcal.com. But one thing I will note is that this product will be coming to market in North America in 2027, so just 3 years away. It is one of the faster product development cycles because of everything that we've learned from our innovation journey with PhotoSeed and soybeans. Just given how quickly this is coming to market, we really invite the chance for growers, industry partners to reach out to us to say, how can I bring this to my community? How can I bring this to my area? Because for something like this to work, it really requires the entire value chain to be connected, to be harmonized, and to all be growing in the same direction. So we look forward to inviting those conversations and making sure that we have all participants at the table.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Han, for taking time to visit with me here and telling us about this announcement of PhotoSeed corn. I'm Chuck Zimmerman reporting.
This is the AgNet NewsHour. We'll be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. The fifth National Climate Assessment is federally mandated by Congress and released every 4 years to serve as the foremost review of research on the current and future impacts of climate change in the United States. In this episode of the Water for Food podcast, DWFI Director of Communications and Public Relations, Frances Hayes, discusses key findings of the report with three of its co-authors.
I'm joined today by two of our faculty fellows, Andrea Baish, Associate Professor in the Department of Agronomy and Horticulture, and Tanya Haig, a Research Assistant Professor, Social Science Coordinator, and Project Coordinator for the National Drought Mitigation Center, as well as Jesse Bell, who leads the Water, Climate, and Health Program at the University of Nebraska Medical Center and is also a part of the leadership team here at DWFI. While their expertise varies quite a bit, all three contributed to the recently released Fifth National Climate Assessment. Federally mandated by Congress and the Global Change Research Act of 1990, the National Climate Assessment is released every 5 years to serve as the foremost review of research on the current and future impacts of climate change in the United States. The assessment includes around 450 authors and 850 total collaborators. Andrea and Tanya were co-authors for the chapter covering the Northern Great Plains, which includes Nebraska. These regional chapters provide detailed discussions of region-specific challenges, opportunities, and success stories for managing risks and impacts of climate change. Jesse was a co-author for the chapter on human health, part of the section on national topics, which summarizes current and future risks related to climate change and what can be done to reduce those risks for a variety of societal and economic sectors of the United States. Andrea, Tanya, and Jesse, I'm really glad we could find some time for all of you to come together virtually, and I'm excited to learn more about your work on this publication. So let's get started. To kick us off, tell us a little bit about each of your expertise, how you got involved as an author for this report, and what all your role entailed.
Sure, I can kick it off. And so I'm Jesse Bell. And as mentioned, I'm faculty at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, University of Nebraska Medical Center. My expertise is actually For a long time, I've been studying the impacts of environmental change and climate change and how it impacts human health. And even before that, I was studying and trying to understand the impacts of climate change on the environment just broadly. And over time, I kind of changed focus because I became very interested in understanding that those changes in the environment and those changes in our climate system and what that actually means to human health. And so I originally started working at NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, through a cooperative institute there. And then eventually I started working at CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. So that's a little bit about me, just in a nutshell.
Thanks, Jesse. Tanya, would you like to go next?
Sure. Yeah, so at the National Drought Mitigation Center, I have worked quite a lot with agricultural producers and communities on their strategies for managing and adapting to drought. So my background is in the social sciences, so that's where I'm coming at this from. And I was invited to co-author the Northern Great Plains chapter, really to contribute to in that way. So to the ways that are resource dependent and our land-based livelihoods in this region are at risk of climate change currently as well in the future, and strategies for how we're adapting and managing those risks.
Great, thanks. And Andrea, tell us how you're involved.
Yeah, thanks, Frances, for bringing us together for this opportunity to highlight its issues of importance from the National Climate Assessment for the listeners. So Andrea Baish, I'm an associate professor in the Department of Agronomy and Horticulture, and my education background is in agronomy, sustainable agriculture, and also applied climate science. So my research focus now is on diversified cropping systems and those that I describe as offering continuous living cover of our land. So that is not perhaps explicitly about climate, but I understand that these approaches to crop management, practices like cover crops or perennial crops, they can prevent soil erosion, improve water holding capacity of the soil, offer a lot of benefits, improving profitability of farmers. They offer a lot of important climate adaptation approaches. So really our work is in agronomy, but thinking about the current and future challenges of climate. And so because of my climate background and that I'm often invited to be a part of climate-related events with climate and agriculture, I was invited to be a part of the National Climate Assessment and contributed more specifically in the agriculture and adaptation sections of the Northern Great Plains chapter.
And actually, I can jump in here because I only answered part of your question, Frances, so I apologize for that.
No problem.
The other part is, how did I get involved in this? I've been, you know, because I've been working in around climate and health for a long time, I was actually previously on the U.S. GCRP, which is a global change research program. There was an interim report between two of the national climate assessments, previous national climate assessments, that was focused just solely on health. And so I was one of the lead authors on that report and was responsible for help bringing that forward. And so that was one of the first comprehensive federal reports to really focus on how climate change impacts human health. And so after getting done with that report, I need a little bit of time off, and they were moving into the fourth climate assessment. So I stepped away and decided I didn't want to work on that assessment at that time. But then when this one came about, because there has been quite a few advances in that space around climate and health, I thought this was a good opportunity for me to kind of step back in and try to add some more of my expertise. And so I volunteered and was very fortunate to be accepted to be part of the team on the health chapter.
Great. Thanks for adding that, Jesse. And I think it's really neat that there are three of you and more, actually, from the University of Nebraska system and connected institutes that participated in that. I think that, you know, really says a lot for the university that all three of you were invited. Plus, there are some others, I think, that serve on it as well. So that's a big win. This assessment is very long. It's over 30 chapters of some great content. But I just now want to focus on some of the key findings of the report. And if you just want to focus on the chapters you co-authored, that's totally fine. As I said, there's a lot to unpack in this report, but what are some of those key findings and how do they compare to previous assessments? Are there anything in particular that is different this time than last time?
I can start. I'd like to kind of underscore the point that you alluded to in your introduction, Francis, which is that the National Climate Assessment is always meant to be a comprehensive assessment of current research. So since the last report, this is an update from the prior report. So the prior report came out in November of 2018. And I also want to underscore, too, that this work comes together over a series of years. We started meeting as a team, you know, 2.5 years before that report was released. And that's many discussions and a lot of coming to consensus about what should be included. And it's reviewing the literature, thinking about news and things that happened in the time since the last report. So Tanya and I, being in Eastern Nebraska, certainly made a point to say we need to mention the 2019 flooding that happened in the state because that was really impactful, just as an example, right? So there's review of literature, thinking about events that have happened, discussion and consensus building with a broad group of authors and contributors, and also phases of public comment. So there's a lot that goes into just what topics are selected. And I would say my memory, it does go back to 2021 when we started the report. And there was, I remember just at a national level, and I'd love to hear if Jesse and Tanya have other thoughts on this, an emphasis on the urgency of the challenges and the impacts of the challenges. And so you'll see in the first chapter of the report, just a recognition that future change depends on the decisions that we make now and the urgency of mitigation and adaptation. And then one other thing I'll say that might be new is that, or a difference in this report, that there was really from the USGCRP, the group that coordinates the report, a request for a more intentional emphasis on the inequities that are created via climate change, that it's often the people and the communities with less ability to cope or who are already marginalized in some way who will be impacted the most, right? So we had this directive to kind of include that in all chapters. And one new thing in the NCA 5 is that there's a separate chapter dedicated exclusively to social systems and justice. So that's kind of my thought about some of the things that are new in this assessment.
You're listening to the AgNet NewsHour. Now for more news. What are the contrasts within USDA's latest look at topsoil moisture condition ratings? Rud Bain tells us.
Regarding USDA's latest topsoil moisture condition ratings,
we see relatively dry conditions in the nation's midsection as of April 14th, contrasting with generally wet conditions across the eastern United States and relatively wet weather in the west.
Nationwide, 30% of the country reports very short to short topsoil moisture conditions, while 14% has topsoil moisture surplus.
Just to put that in a little bit of perspective on the surplus side of things, over the last decade, the record for surplus topsoil moisture was 37% back in May of 2019.
Yet May of 2020 was the last time topsoil moisture surplus was above 20%. As for the latest very short-to-short topsoil moisture rating,
that is actually a bit on the high side, too, for the last decade. There's only 2 years we've seen numbers higher than 30% at this time of year. That was 2021 and 2022.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
That's today's Top Agriculture News. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet NewsHour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.